Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. Earlier this year, West Virginia Public Broadcasting was honored with a national award from the Public Media Journalists Association. The series, Coal and the Way Forward, won a first-place honor for excellence for work from the newsroom and for the program Inside Appalachia. I'm Trey Kay, host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Us and Them. Our team also focused on the coal industry with a look at how its history shaped today's reality. 100 years ago, West Virginia was home to our nation's largest and most violent uprising since the American Civil War. For some, the Battle of Blair Mountain was a watershed moment when coal miners decided their rights were worth fighting, even dying for. The armed insurrection in 1921 pitted 10,000 coal miners against 3,000 heavily armed coal industry guards and state troopers. It was a conflict that came to a head from the social and economic forces that hit coal country after World War I. We'd like to share this with you again, an episode from our archives, which was honored with an award from the Virginia's Associated Press Broadcasters, and where I follow the path of the miners on their march to Mingo. And a heads up, a little later in this episode, we'll hear about ways women were abused and assaulted in coal towns. The plain talk about sexual assault is not for all listeners. On a busy street in the middle of Midtown Manhattan on a hot July day. There are police barricades and a crowd of marchers dressed in green camo t-shirts, cheering a man at a microphone.
This is the longest strike in Alabama history. I want this to be the biggest, largest, strongest labor rally in the history of Alabama. Will you meet us in Alabama?
The man addressing the crowd is union boss Cecil Roberts. He's president of the United Mine Workers of America. This protest brought together union workers and even the occasional celebrity.
Thank you so much for being here. When we're together, we will win.
All to support striking mine workers. Union miners at Warrior Met Coal in Alabama have been without a contract for more than 100 days. This rally is in Manhattan at the headquarters of the Black Rock Corporation. They have a controlling interest in the mine. This strike is notable, considering the current weakened state of labor unions in America. The past few decades have seen a rise of non-union mining operations and the slow decline of unions throughout coal country and in other industries. But this rally is notable because it falls on the 100th anniversary of an event many consider the birth of the modern labor movement.
Why did you come here today? Well, to support the strikers from Alabama. They've been on strike for over 100 days. They deserve a fair and just contract.
Just out of curiosity, have you ever heard of the Battle of Blair Mountain?
Yes, I have. Sure I have.
What do you know about it?
I mean, I know that they were trying to organize the workers in Logan County. I think it happened back in 1921, if I'm not mistaken. It's the largest insurrection in the history of the United States. I mean, it's very historic. It's 100 years. This is a never-ending fight. So, you know, you've got to be mindful of your history. You've got to understand what it took to get from where we are today and where we have to go. Takes sacrifice and struggle. Most important of all, it takes solidarity.
As the old saying goes, those who do not know their history are destined to repeat it. That begs the question, what do you know about the events in 1921? What do you know about the Battle of Blair Mountain? From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, you're listening to Us and Them, the show that tells the stories about the things that divide us. I'm Trey Kay.
Was the year, seems like yesterday to me. Let me tell you about what happened then, back in the mine country. We were fighting hard to build a union, 'cause at 40 cents a ton, there was no way to feed a family when the mining day was done. Now we're marching on to Mingo, 10,000 men and counting, here in the hills of West Virginia. Hit the Battle of Blair Mountain.
The Battle of Blair Mountain is something of an enigma in modern history. A complex conflict that was the result of a number of social and economic forces that came to a head in West Virginia's coal country after World War I. The result was an armed march from Marmette to Mingo. The Battle of Blair Mountain pitted 10,000 coal miners against 3,000 heavily armed coal industry guards and state troopers. Identifying the winners and losers, or heroes and the villains, is largely dependent on your point of view. But there are some facts concerning the battle that are not in dispute. It was the largest labor uprising in American history, and the largest armed uprising since the Civil War. And yet, the Battle of Blair Mountain is largely unknown to most Americans, including West Virginians who live in the shadow of Blair Mountain. To understand the complex history, we followed the path of the miners on their march to Mingo, and we brought along the foremost expert on this event, Professor Charles Keeney.
How's it going?
Good.
Nice to meet you.
Trey K. So, we're going on a little journey?
I guess we are. So it's on to Marmette, I suppose.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right.
Now, if you want to know about the Battle of Blair Mountain, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more authoritative figure than Chuck Keeney. His credentials on this particular subject, well, let's just say they are impressive.
I'm a history professor at Southern West Virginia Community and Technical College, and I also was president of Friends of Blair Mountain, the historic preservation group that worked to save the Blair Mountain battlefield. I'm a founding member of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, and I am the author of the book, The Road to Blair Mountain. The Mine Wars refers to a series of labor conflicts that occurred in West Virginia, mostly between 1912 and 1921 is where the main action took place. And these conflicts became very violent, and they were among the most violent labor conflicts in American history. And you had a form of guerrilla warfare that broke out, beginning in Kanawha County on Paint Creek and Cabin Creek. And the issues were more than just simply unionization or non-unionization, and that's important to remember. because this was about breaking a industrial police state in West Virginia.
Following World War I, the economic forces at play in the West Virginia coalfields hit miners hard. They became pawns in a power battle between the coal industry and the gathering momentum of the union movement.
Coal operators in West Virginia were determined to keep the United Mine Workers out. And the reason they were determined to keep the United Mine Workers out is because West Virginia coal is further away from the big industrial markets than the coal mines in, say, Illinois, Indiana, Pennsylvania, etc. So they have to ship their coal farther, so it's more expensive. So they have to keep production costs down in order to outsell their competitors in other states. So the coal industry in West Virginia felt it was crucial to their bottom line to keep the union out. The United Mine Workers, in order to keep their contracts in these other states, felt it was crucial to organize West Virginia to keep their organization afloat.
The conflict gave the miners no choice. The West Virginia coalfields were ripe for organization. Working conditions were hazardous, and the health of the miners was constantly at risk. Coal miners lived under a form of indentured servitude. Miners were paid with company currency, and workers could only spend their pay at company-owned stores.
They're not paid in American money. What does that mean?
They're paid in company money, scrip, as it is called. Not script, as in something that you read for a movie, but scrip, with a P. And this was money, fake money, that the companies would manufacture that would only be redeemable at the company store. And each different company had their own scrip. The miners also had to buy everything at the company store. It gave back almost 100% profit to the coal companies. So you got everything at the company store, your clothes, your food, you picked up your mail there. They also had to buy their own equipment. They were not provided equipment to mine with. They had to buy their own drills, dynamite, canaries, canary cages, everything. They had to buy at the company stores. By the way, and very early on, this is something I just found out recently, but early on in some of the coal fields, they sold cocaine in the company stores. They would pack up their pipes with cocaine and smoke it before a shift so they could dig more coal. And a lot of miners weren't even drawing anything with each paycheck because every single dime that they were making was being sucked up by the company store. So you're not able to accrue any wealth, you're not able to get ahead. And this has been a consistent aspect of the extraction economy.
In early 1920, the union movement in West Virginia gained enough momentum that a conflict between miners and mining companies was inevitable. And the first domino was set to fall during an event referred to as the Matewan Massacre.
In the spring of 1920, the UMWA began an organizing drive of the only three counties that were left that were non-unionized: Logan, Mingo, and McDowell. And so after the war, they do a major organizing drive. And they're successful, but of course, as miners tried to unionize, many of them were evicted from their company housing. So it's on May 19th, 1920, in which a bunch of Baldwin Phelps detectives come into town, into Matewan, and they're going to evict miners that are living in some camps outside of town. In the town of Matewan, you had a chief of police named Sid Hatfield who was sympathetic to the miners. And this was very, very rare. Somebody on the side of the law that was also on the side of the miners. Usually law enforcement was firmly within the pockets of the coal industry. And at the end of the day, there's a confrontation between Hatfield and other deputies that he had deputized throughout the course of the day and the Baldwin Phelps detectives in Matewan before the evening train arrived, and that resulted in the shootout that the industry refers to as the Matewan Massacre. The reason they call it a massacre is because more of them died than miners. The miners refer to it as the Battle of Matewan. And what this does is this sparks the union movement even more. More and more miners join the union, more of them get evicted, and they get emboldened by this. And Hatfield becomes a major ally of the striking miners.
But Police Chief Sid Hatfield is charged with crimes for his role in the Matewan Massacre. The next summer, he's scheduled to stand trial at the McDowell County Courthouse. As soon as Chief Hatfield arrived at the courthouse steps, he's gunned down by a group of Baldwin Felt's detectives. That heavily armed security force protected the interests of West Virginia mining companies. They worked under the direction of Sheriff Don Chafin from neighboring Logan County. At this point, an already combustible situation was completely unstable. Miners resolved to avenge Hatfield's murder by marching to Mingo, where they would hang Sheriff Chafin from a sour apple tree.
So this is the spot where the miners began to assemble. And on August the 7th, they had this huge meeting at the Capitol with 5,000 or 6,000 miners. They tried to petition the governor. Governor Morgan would not meet with the miners. That's when my great-grandfather famously came out and told the miners that the only way you can get your rights is with a high-powered rifle. Told them to go home and await the call to march.
Now, I just want to make sure that everyone caught Chuck Keeney's reference to his great-grandfather just now. Remember when I said Chuck's Blair Mountain credentials were impressive? Well, as it turns out, Chuck's great-grandfather was Frank Keeney, a central figure in West Virginia's union movement and a primary organizer of the March on Mingo.
It was probably around 5,000 miners that initially departed from Marmette, and their ranks would more than double by the time they would reach Blair Mountain. This was a convenient spot because it was close to Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, where you had some of the most militant union miners there. So this was the good spot to begin the trek to try to get to Mingo County. It was always to get to Mingo County. Blair Mountain was not the objective. Blair Mountain was in the way because that was the defensive entrenchments of where Don Chafin and the state police put up their forces.
When it marched out of the Tuck Fort, when Sid Hatfield was shot down at the Logan County Courthouse, cold cops fired around. 10,000 Union miners were Bloody Mingo bound, and they say up on Blair Mountain you still can hear the sound.
An organized force of 1,000 armed miners now headed to Mingo. As Chuck Keeney and I drove along the route, followed by the miners, he described what must have been a spectacle.
They came through here and they were stretched out, you know, along several miles.
What do you mean stretched out?
The miners, like you had the front guard, like a vanguard that was up front, and then, you know, the line of miners that were marching were stretched out for numerous miles. For example, the first miners reached Blair at August the 30th, but they kept pouring in for about 5 days after that.
If you would have lived in this area and you were not joining the parade, you just saw like a long stream of miners just marching from Marmette to, Blair Mountain.
Yes, it was just a huge continual stream.
How many people?
By the time you get to Blair, there's at least 10,000. There's probably by the end of the battle somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 involved. Many of them joined as things were going. So we don't know the exact number. 10,000 is the standard number of used, but it was probably a bit higher than that.
So where are we now?
We are in Madison, and we are going to pull over.
As with all historical events, context is key. The post-World War I era was marked by a global rise in popular rights movements. They pitted the interests of the people against government and industry. Entities with power took aggressive actions to put down racial minorities and working poor communities. Just a few months prior to Blair Mountain, the Greenwood Massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, saw an entire prosperous African-American community burned to the ground by forces of the establishment.
And remember, this is within 90 days of Tulsa happening, the Tulsa Massacre taking place. You've got a lot of unrest taking place across the Western world. You have major strikes going on in the United States. You just had a steelworkers strike of 300,000 steelworkers earlier in the year. You had uprisings in Ireland, in Germany. So they're worried that this is going to assume huge proportions and the military is going to come in, and they would use that as an excuse to stamp out the union movement across America.
When news of the West Virginia Miners' March reached President Warren G. Harding, he thought about calling in the U.S. military.
General H.H. Bandholt gets sent into Charleston in the early morning hours of August the 27th. President Harding is actually reluctant at first to send in troops. And he wants Bandholtz to come in and personally assess the situation and see how things were going. Bandholtz meets with Keeney and Mooney about 5 in the morning at the state capitol and tells them, you have to get the miners to turn around and come back, because if you don't, we're bringing in the U.S. military and we're going to use the full force of the military to put this down. And it's going to be a slaughter if you don't turn them back. So Frank Keeney and Fred Mooney get in a car, and they take roughly the similar route that we just took and catch up to the miners in Madison. And they call a meeting of the miners, and the miners assemble right very close to the spot where we're standing. And Frank Keeney gives them a talk. And the general story goes that Keeney tells the miners that they have to turn back, that the U.S. military is going to be called in, and it's life or death, and they can't fight the U.S. military. They can fight the mine guards, but they can't beat the U.S. military. And the miners agree that they're going to turn around and go back. But later that day, in the evening of the 27th, J.R. Brockus, the same guy that led the attack on the Lick Creek Tent Colony, crosses Blair Mountain with 70 state troopers, and they have a shootout with a bunch of miners that had kind of were the advance guard of the miners' march. They arrest a number of them. They have a shootout that leaves at least 3 people dead. After that shootout happens, the march is back on.
So where are we going next?
We're going to Blair. We are not far.
The Battle of Blair Mountain became inevitable. Every time conflict could have been avoided, outside forces pushed the miners and the coal company back toward violence.
You haven't seen the Logan County line yet, have you?
I don't think so.
Okay. This is Route 17 we're on, by the way. And this was an actual road in 1921. Well, I mean, it was... It was a dirt trail. It wasn't paved or anything.
There's a sign there that says the Battle of Blair Mountain. I might want to take a picture of that.
Here we are at the southern crest of Blair Mountain. This is where we stopped. This is where the march ended, right here. Let's hop out. Open my book
talking about this exact spot. When Chuck Keeney and I get to the top, we're standing at the high ground where the mine guards and the state troopers set up machine gun positions to attack the miners advancing up the steep slope of Blair Mountain. It was a near impossible task for the miners, similar in many ways to the Allied forces' invasion of Normandy in World War II. Chuck explains what happened next.
Miners had arrived in Blair and up around Crooked Creek area, which is to the northwest of here, on August the 30th. They waited for more troops to arrive. And then on the next day, scouts were going out, checking out the area around Blair Mountain, around this area here. And it was an advance scout, and they ran into an advance scout of Don Chaffin's forces. Both sides asked for the password, and then they both gave the wrong password, and then they started firing. So after that, the fighting was on. And the fighting continued on through August 31st until September the 4th, when federal troops arrived at Blair.
So there was the battle. The United States Army, federal troops come here, and from what I understand, the miners lay down their arms.
That's correct. They did. Many of them buried their weapons, some of them up on Blair Mountain, so that they wouldn't have to be confiscated, and hid them. Many others just flat out surrendered. Of course, many of them were World War I veterans, and their beef was not with the federal government. Their beef was with the mine guards, with the state government, with the way that was being handled. And so they weren't anti-American, even though they were often painted as being such. So when federal troops arrived, yes, they did lay down their arms and they did surrender.
The surrender of the miners brought an end to the Battle of Blair Mountain and the March on Mingo. And as with every hard-fought battle, the end of hostilities leads us to the question. Was it worth it?
As far as I understand, it's the largest labor uprising in our nation's history.
Yeah, it's
bloody.
Yeah.
Did the people who brought this, did they gain anything?
Yeah, the initial aftermath was it got worse instead of getting better. But in some ways, the threat of more industrial violence is going to be a catalyst to encourage reform that is going to be taken on by the federal government the following decade. But it's going to be a tough decade in between that time. The roaring 20s weren't very roaring in West Virginia. But again, I don't want to put too pretty of a bow on it, because the Battle of Blair Mountain failed to alter the power structure in West Virginia. The power structure remained intact. The government is still controlled by the industry. The local media is still controlled by the industry. The school systems are still controlled by the industry. So even unionization comes, the history is not going to be told. The power structure is going to remain intact. And because that power structure remained intact and remains intact to this very day, we have the situation that we have here. They say our motto is mountaineers are always free. Maybe mountaineers are always fighting to be free, but we certainly aren't always free.
In many ways, the Battle of Blair Mountain might be West Virginia's ultimate us and them story.
It is. It is. It's us and them. And when you can talk about mountaineers versus absentee landowners, it's us and them when you think of working class versus ruling class. It's kind of us and them as like West Virginia versus the world. And this is maybe the ultimate us and them place. Blair Mountain is labor's Gettysburg. It is a crucial moment in which the miners themselves were fighting for basic American rights. We talk about veterans of wars and talk about them sacrificing themselves for the freedoms that we enjoy. Well, what about the 8-hour workday, the 40-hour work week, weekends, pensions, unemployment benefits, all of those things, they had to be fought for and they had to be bled for and in some cases died for. So that's why you want to remember what happened there. Nice. Americans need to understand the significance of labor history and unions in building America and turning America into a place where liberty can be enjoyed.
The Battle of Blair Mountain was a miners' fight. But the women of West Virginia played a significant role in the uprising. After a break, we'll hear how injustices against women in the coal fields contributed to the rising tensions that led to the March on Mingo. We'll also hear from union and industry leaders about the legacy of Blair Mountain and a celebrity with strong views about the role of unions in our current political climate. You're listening to Us and Them from PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. This program is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
Hey, it's Trey. And this is Us and Them from PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. A heads up, we will hear about ways women were abused and assaulted in coal towns. The plain talk about sexual assault is not for all listeners.
Rise up!
That's Mary Hott singing a track from her new album, Devil in the Hills. The irony of her use of the West Virginia State motto, Mountaineers are always free, is that mountaineers may always be fighting for freedom, but true freedom has been elusive. Devil in the Hills is a reminder of life in West Virginia mining towns set to music. It's a contemporary contribution to the rich canon of songs from the Coalfields. In particular, Mary Hott's songs focus on the culture of the company store and its effect on women. Hott is an amateur historian, and her songs are based on personal research and oral histories from people with ties to life in West Virginia mining towns. Hott says the dark side for women involved sexual abuse and rape. To give us a better perspective on this aspect of life in a coal town, I traveled with Mary Hott to one of the last remaining company stores in Fayette County, West Virginia, the Whipple Company Store. After closing up, the building became a private museum and now sits empty. The thing that I like about your album is that you really want to throw a lot of attention onto the stories that weren't told and the women's roles in how this mining story played out in West Virginia.
Well, and you know, a lot of these wives took up arms with their husbands when it got to the war part, you know, when they really had to march and you know, when they were striking, in other words. You know, women had a lot of role to play there too. But I've had women say to me, after hearing these stories, they have their own family stories. I mean, I have women around my age that are saying to me, yeah, my aunt, she was basically sold, you know, for money, you know. Coal agents or coal management, you know, would come into their town and offer money to families to rent their daughters.
Hott's work on Devil in the Hills is important in recognizing the injustices of its time. But the work took on additional meaning as the Me Too effort pushed back against sexual abuse and the exploitation of women.
I stopped and started this project several times. It became overwhelming. You know, it was difficult material, emotionally difficult to deal with. And I have to tell you, the summer of Me Too, I said to myself, you've got to finish this. You know, people are speaking out. It's safer to speak out. You know, you can't speak out and not be basically called a liar or, you know, dismissed, which is just as hurtful. We just arrived. We're at Whipple. It's right here. Oh, my God. Oh, it's out of repair again. Oh, it's so sad. I mean, look, there's boards missing. And oh, my gosh.
After arriving at the Whipple Company store, Mary explained some of the building's shadowy past. She talked to the former owner of the building, who ran the place as a museum. Lots of people would visit and reminisce about growing up in the community. But some of the stories told of sexual abuse that allegedly took place here. Those stories include a special form of scrip, the company store currency, that was given to women. They say it was called Esau scrip, named after the biblical parable of Jacob and Esau.
So scrip was the company money, their currency, how they paid their workers. Couldn't be used anywhere else, had to be only used here in the store. And apparently there was a special scrip, which is really just these little tags of paper. So this Esau scrip was handed to women whose husbands had been injured and couldn't work anymore. If a man wasn't digging coal, they were going to be evicted.
So a man could be injured in the course of his work. Or I'm imagining they could have gotten ill, you know, caught a cold or pneumonia or flu or something like that. But for a while, they are incapacitated and unable to work.
Right. So the scrip, the special scrip, was given to a woman to basically buy food, you know, for the family, keep the family alive. But it was due in 30 days, which, you know, for some injuries, 30 days isn't long enough. But if the man went back to work within 30 days, it was forgiven. If the man didn't go back to work, the debt was paid back by assigning the woman something to pay back with. And in a lot of cases, it was sex.
Quit your staring on my feet. I'm wearing cardboard, rope and twine. Suits me fine. Ain't got no Esau script, won't pay those dues. You can't tempt me with no pretty shoes.
Esau script became the inspiration for the song Don't Take the Esau,
which features a verse about a particularly dark place in the Whipple Company store, known as the Shoe Room.
In another verse, there's the perspective of a woman who says, you know, quit staring on my feet, I'm wearing cardboard, rope, and twine, and it suits me just fine. Ain't got no Esau script, and I won't pay those dues, and you can't tempt me with those pretty shoes.
Yeah, that's the whole Shoe Room story. Many, many, many women have corroborated that story. If you could barely pay the rent and the food, you're not going to have money left over for shoes. The story is that women, you know, would come in and, you know, like a mine guard would see that the kids didn't have shoes, or the women themselves were either barefoot or their shoes were totally worn out. They would take them to the Shoe Room. It was that far right room over there on the second floor. Show them the shoes, have them do a fitting, and then rape them in exchange. And in the story, the woman had told that her grandmother kept this box of shoes that had been given to her after that experience. She put it up on the shelf in the closet and not only never wore those shoes, she never wore any shoes. She would basically just wrap her feet in newspaper. She never wore shoes again. It was such a traumatic experience for her. I think it happened many times because, you know, this is not something women would go back and tell. I mean, you know, you're going to hide this for one reason or another. Now, today, we will finally speak out.
It's important to point out a few things here. Barry Hott's assertions are controversial among historians. There is little, if any, documented evidence to support the existence of systemic abuse against women. There are some artifacts that may be Esau script, but historians have not yet verified them. The information about shoe rooms and sexual assaults lives mostly in the form of oral history, stories shared between some women about the dark side of mining life. Some historians do concede that women in these mining towns were vulnerable, and it's even more plausible that they could have been the victims of sexual abuse by men in positions of power. Mary was traveling with her guitar. So she sat on the front steps of the Whipple Company store to play Take the Esau. And just as she finished the song, something quite unexpected happened.
Mother took the Esau, had no choice, had no other options, had no voice. Kept us kids from starving, kept our home. He faced the consequences all alone. She had to pay. Forced to give her birthright away. Don't take the Esau, such a price to pay. Don't take my birthright away.
Who's that? Someone's inside. There's someone inside. He's tapping on the window. Hello? Do you like my song? Hi. Well, you scared the hell out of me. I was sitting here going, okay, maybe there are ghosts in there.
Fortunately for us, the tapping on the window wasn't a ghost, but Roger Shoemake, the caretaker of the Whipple Company store.
I'm going to ask, and you can say no. You can't show us inside, can you?
All right, let's do it.
Oh, man, I can't believe
it. I have to tell you, Roger, I was kind of hoping somebody like you was going to show up.
After operating for a number of years as a privately run museum, the building was sold. Since then, it's remained boarded up and empty, except for the caretaker and perhaps the occasional ghost.
So, this is the shoe room over here.
This is where a woman's ghost had been seen several times, and this is where, what Roger was just telling us, where there were two boards, and they pried it up, and there was an old girl's tintype photo down underneath. But there was a young woman that died after
being raped in here.
After leaving the store, Mary and I talked about what we saw and whether injustices against women played a role in the events that led up to the uprising at Blair Mountain.
I don't know how many women hid their own personal experiences from their husbands. Some of these husbands may have known about the Esau script. Some may have not. But it's an indicator of the level of atrocities that these people endured, the miners and their families. Whether it was being cheated out of how much coal they dug, the weight of their coal, or their wife was raped, or they were beat up because they were suspected of talking to somebody about unionization, or they were murdered because they were caught organizing, you know, for a union. So it's like, you know, did they strike because they weren't being paid enough for what they dug? I don't think that's the only thing. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff.
Of course, the coal industry in West Virginia was and still is one key part of the state's economic survival. There are many who see the industry as a force for good in the state. And among those people is Bill Rainey, former president of the West Virginia Coal Association.
I'm Bill Rainey. I'm retired and have spent the majority, no, all my working life, actually, with the coal industry. I began as a surface mine inspector, and then the remainder of the time, 28 years, almost 29, I was the West Virginia Coal Association. I retired from that at the end of 2020. You know, just a West Virginia boy.
Now, as you listen to Bill Rainey, it's important to keep in mind that he's not just an industry suit spreading coal propaganda for personal gain. He was born and raised within the same company town system that fueled the union movement. His perspectives are based on personal experience.
I grew up for the first 7 years of my life in a coal camp. And the houses were owned by the company. The store was owned by the company. My father worked for the company. I never experienced any of those kind of things, owing your soul to the company store. And I mean, there was a camaraderie in the coal camp that I grew up in. Perhaps it's unique. I don't know. But it was a very positive experience.
Specifically, on the topic of Blair Mountain, Rainey's point of view is that it was just one of many events in the growth of the labor movement.
I think it's a critical story in West Virginia history, certainly, and certainly a critical part of labor history. From the industry standpoint, I think it's something most people are aware of just simply by the name of Blair Mountain. But I don't think it's anything that sticks with them. You know, whatever lesson you want to learn, I guess you can learn from it. And it's more important to some people than it is others.
In today's coal economy, Rainey sees the industry's move toward non-union operations as decidedly positive and sees it as promoting better workplace relations between the mine workers and the coal companies.
The whole idea behind the non-union thing was the folks in the companies felt like we need to get more in control of our folks and thereby know them and do everything and not depend on the union to manage our workforce. From a management standpoint, just generally speaking, I think it's better because I think everybody's much more interpersonal with everyone. They know their folks. Joe is dealing with Clyde, and Clyde's dealing with Cecil, and Cecil's dealing with Lucille, and you're not dealing with the union contract, whoever they say is going to work there and who's going to do exactly what they're supposed to be doing per the contract. So I think there's a lot more interpersonal relationship that goes on in today's world.
But here's a twist. Bill Rainey credits union efforts for establishing the very workplace standards on which today's non-union operations are based.
You know, the labor movement had a significant benefit for those that are working in today's industry because it kind of set the standard of pay, set the standard of benefits, the union contracts did. The platform off of which everything worked for a non-union operation to start is, you know, you had to pay the people a certain amount of money, had to have a certain level of benefits. And that was typically laid out by previous union contracts, what they were getting.
There's a popular image that unions and the industry are locked together in constant conflict. The truth is that they very often work together. This is clear when Rainey talks about his personal friendship with union boss Cecil Roberts. He's the president of the Mine Workers Union. At the top of the show, we heard him speaking at the rally in Manhattan. Both men understand that the survival of the coal economy is key to the survival of both the industry and the union.
Cecil's a great guy. I mean, I think he's a wonderful, wonderful man doing a wonderful job with what he's been doing for a long time.
He said the same about you, by the way.
Oh, did? Well, yeah. That'll probably run both of us then. But, you know, you shake Cecil's hand and you know he's going to do everything he said he's going to do. And hopefully I'd be the same way. But they helped us a great deal in all this environmental upheaval of the coal industry that was taking jobs and not providing for permits. And, you know, it was causing all kinds of turmoil in the thing. And Cecil always thought and always said that, you know, if you help us get the permits and we'll put the people to work and we'll get the mining out there, then it's up to you to go organize them. But you can't organize a mine that isn't operating. We've got to get them working. And then it's the choice of the people at the workplace as to whether or not they want to be represented by the United Mine Workers.
After speaking with Bill Rainey, we checked in with Cecil Roberts to get his perspective on the legacy of Blair Mountain. Predictably, he has a different take.
If miners had not been willing to stand up and fight and march on Blair Mountain in 1921 or risk their lives in a Matewan conflict in 1920, we wouldn't be nowhere near where we are or where we ultimately ended up in the 30s as the most powerful union in the country. The union took terrible jobs and made those middle-class jobs over the years. People sometimes who don't make as much money as a coal miner say, why should a miner get all that money? Well, I always told people when I was working in the mines, I get paid X amount of money for what I do, then I get another X amount of money for where I do it. And that's underground and risking my life and my health as a coal miner.
Roberts finished our conversation with a bold statement about the place of unions in our society.
Look at the number of people that were being killed in these coal mines because they didn't have health and safety. Look at the number of people who were beaten and killed just because they spoke out. Look at the number of people who were fired back in those days and blacklisted and couldn't get a job in the coal industry anywhere just because they wanted things to be better. There are so many people who lost their lives in this industry either trying to form a union or in the mines themselves and trying to make them safer. Now, if the union's not around, what's going to happen? We think that benefits will always be high. Do we think wages will be fair? Do we think the mines will be safe? The answer to that is probably no. So it's always been the union that made the industry what it is. When I said a few minutes ago that the union made those terrible jobs good jobs, that's true. If there's no union, will those jobs remain good jobs? And the answer to that is no. If there are no unions in America, no one will have a good job.
Back at the rally in Manhattan, the parallels between the historical and the current union efforts for economic justice are clear. Today's union protesters use cell phones and social media instead of rifles and shotguns. But the belief in the power of the collective remains the same. And there was one voice at the rally that stood out in the crowd.
Thank you so much for being here. I welcome you. One day longer, one day stronger. When we're together, we will win. So stick with it. I'll be watching. Thank you all for coming to our city, and more power to you.
Do you recognize that voice? That's celebrated actor and New York resident Susan Sarandon, who's an active union supporter and a friend to West Virginia. I asked her about the importance of strong unions in this country.
I think unions are what built this country. Unions are very important. It's all we have left to try to hold the working class together. And I just want to bring my voice and my platform to let people know what's going on so that they can be supported. And not only supported, but I think when we saw what the teachers unions did in West Virginia, and you know, we should have the right to strike in order to get basic human dignity. It's just, I think, very important for other unions to see this kind of strength and organization, because that's what we're going to have to do. I don't think any kind of saving is going to come from the top down. It's going to have to come from the people. I really believe unions are what's going to help keep this country from falling through the cracks. And if we start to lose unions, well, then we're really going to be in trouble. And I think all of us in a union have to support other unions in their struggles.
United Men, Workers of America!
For some people, the Battle of Blair Mountain was a watershed moment seeking justice for workers in America. It was a moment when workers decided their rights were worth fighting and even dying for. Today, unions are on the defensive, and once again, workers are coming out in numbers to fight for their rights. It makes me wonder, are we at a plateau in the arc of history? Or could there be another bend on the horizon? You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this show is me, Trey Kay, Brad Stratton, and Kate Smith. The music that we heard on this episode helps tell the story of Blair Mountain. And to hear more of these songs, why don't you visit our show notes, where we've provided a link to a Spotify playlist. And there you'll also find a link to information about Mary Hott's Devil in the Hills album. Special thanks to David Adkins and Shepard Snyder for help on this episode. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozal wrote and performed the Us and Them show music, and Brad Stratton provided additional music for this episode. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Lelena Price provides us with images for the web. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the CRC Foundation, and the West Virginia Humanities Council. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them. Hey, Trey here again. And that archived podcast episode of Us and Them was originally posted in September of 2021.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.